as an adult.
Good morning, everyone. The meeting will come to order. The clerk will note the roll. There is a quorum. We have the minutes of the January 11th meeting before us. Are there any corrections, additions, changes to the minutes? Representative Carlson moves approval of the minutes. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The minutes of January 11th are approved. Members, we have three bills before us today. They're on the schedule, House File 3, House File 235, and House File 234. First up is House File 3. And the chair will move that House File 3 be referred to the General Register. And I'll call upon the author of the bill, Representative Smith, to present the bill. Representative Smith, welcome to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you. Mr. Chair, I have an author's amendment, A-10. Could we deal with that now?
Certainly. Chair will move the A-10 amendment. Representative Smith, can you describe the amendment?
It's a technical amendment to get the bill in the shape that the author would like.
Okay, and as I understand, Representative Smith, it removes, I believe it's $60,000 of appropriations that are no longer needed because we're not doing some of the extra mailings that were originally anticipated for driver's licenses. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, members, yes, that is correct. That's the reduction for the $60,000, the mailings. In addition, the programming costs are less than anticipated as well.
All right. Okay, does anyone have any questions on the A-10 amendment? See no questions or discussion. All in favor of the A-10 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The A-10 amendment is adopted. Representative Smith.
Mr. Chair, members, House File 3, Real ID, gives consumers a choice. They can opt into the Real ID program, or they can have the same license that they have today. The time frame for this bill, if this bill gets passed and signed into law this session, then we will ask the Department of Homeland Security for an extension, which will allow the department to issue licenses up until October of 2020, the final date. If this bill does not pass this session, we're faced with a hard deadline of roughly 1 year from today, which means that commercial air travel will not be able to happen. In addition, there'll be no admittance to federal buildings, military facilities, and also power plants. There is a fiscal... there is a, in the fiscal note, which we'll cover in more detail by staff, in fiscal year 2019, there is $10 million. That is the first part of that is for the license that are going to be needed for people who will be doubling up within the four-year period.
Okay, well, members, I would direct your attention to the fiscal note that's in your packet. If you look at the date, you'll note that it was completed on Saturday, 2 days ago. And so we did get kind of a last-minute fiscal note on this. Previously, I don't believe, if I recall correctly, there was any sort of special revenue fund expenditure in 18 or 19. Now it is anticipated that there is something in 19, although it's, I believe, and this is something I'm going to ask the department to come forward in a little bit here, too, after we're done with fiscal analyst Mr. Lee. But there are a few changes from what the fiscal note was that we had last week, and so, members, I direct your attention to that, and I think I'll have our fiscal analyst, Andrew Lee, bring us through this new updated fiscal note, and then I'll have some questions for the department. Mr. Lee, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. If you go to the fiscal note on the first page, you see 3 years' worth of costs spread out, $10.1 million in 19, $10.1 million in 2020, and $5.1 million in 2021 on the first page. But there's quite a bit more detail into these costs. If you look on pages 2 and 3, particularly on page 3, under the header expenditure and revenue formula DVS. This is the numbers that add up to the larger $10 million figure. And so this is essentially the department's estimate for how many licenses will be applied for that would essentially be free to the consumer and as a result have a impact on the revenue to the special revenue fund that funds driver and vehicle services. So, in a sense, if you add up the numbers in that paragraph and then using the estimate that the agency has at the top of the page, which assumes that 40% of no-fee cards will be issued in fiscal year 2019, 40% in fiscal year 2020, and 20% in fiscal year 2021, that gets pretty close to the 10 million in 19, 10 million in 2020, and 5 million in 2021. And there's a few other smaller costs in there, a biennial audit, and some essentially revenue in, revenue out, relating to the second and third paragraphs further down the BCA background check requirements. So this sort of a primer in how driver and vehicle services is funded is the fees that are collected by either deputy registrars or the Department of Driver and Vehicle Services go into a special revenue fund for either vehicle transactions, title transfers, driver's licenses, and then the legislature makes a direct appropriation out of that special revenue fund to cover the operating expenses of the agency. So in offering free license cards to people that would have to renew earlier than they otherwise would have, that decreases the amount of fee revenue to one of the special revenue funds, the Vehicle Services Fund. Currently, as of the 9th of this month, there is about a $7 million unrestricted fund balance in that fund, and then another $10 million in building contingency and 2 months' worth of working capital. So, in effect, the cost in this bill, starting in fiscal 19, would mean a decrease to that fund, the fund would be able to bear, assuming that the current revenue stream and appropriations are the same as they are now, but those decisions would take place in the transportation budget. That's helpful.
Okay, does anyone have any questions for Mr. Lee? Representative Hilsman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm interested in how you came up with the numbers that you think that will renew every year or phased in. If everyone finds out that they can get a new license for free, why wouldn't people who want to have that just go and do it right away? And then what happens if everyone who's eligible does go right away? How do you pay the bill?
Yeah, Mr. Lee, you can answer that if you want, but that might be more of an appropriate question for the department. But Mr. Lee?
Mr. Chair and Representative Hillstrom, no, I didn't come up with the assumptions. The agency came up with the assumptions, and they can speak to them. I will note, though, in an earlier fiscal note, they did assume that essentially everyone would come in 1 year and put all the costs in fiscal 2021. But since that fiscal note, they have had a new estimate, assuming the 40-40-20 split.
Any other questions for Mr. Lee? Otherwise, I'll bring the department up. Okay, thank you, Mr. Lee. If we could have a representative of the department come forward to talk about the fiscal note and answer questions. Good morning. Welcome to the Committee on Ways and Means. Can you state your name for the record, and then we'll get into some questions.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Don Olson, and I'm the Director of Driver and Vehicle Services.
Well, thank you, Ms. Olson. Thanks for being here. I guess maybe you can start out by answering Representative Hillstrom's question. Representative Hillstrom, maybe you could repeat the question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The question was, how did you come up with the assumptions that everyone that's eligible just wouldn't come in if they knew they could get a free license? And what happens if more people come in than what you've budgeted? How do you actually pay for the processing of those licenses?
Director Olson.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, we base this assumption truly on the fact, on the numbers that we generally would renew in 1 year's period of time and broke it down by the different types of licenses. So essentially these are all citizens that would be eligible for a license because there's no way of us distinguishing who may or may not come in. So our assumption is based on if everybody that was eligible during the period when we did not issue a real ID that wanted to come in before the end of their renewal period did come in, that's how we got to that total budget. So our assumption is based on not that we have an overrun, but that this is pretty standard numbers for our operation about what we would handle on a year's basis. But this would cover, or this includes not only what our operating costs would include, but as well as the filing fee that goes to the deputy registrars. Both of those would have to, we have to compensate for those somewhere, and that would be the cost involved.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the follow-up then is, what happens if more people come in than what you have assumed? Then how do you make up that money?
Director Olson.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I think we would have to take that and come before this committee and speak to that at this committee. We just don't have a definitive number to know exactly how many could come. But we would have a number to know how many that we did renew during the non-compliant period. We would have a better estimate, and that's basically what we're estimating it on now. So while it's not an exact number, we feel our estimates are pretty close to what reality could be. And like I said, if there were any major fluctuations, we would certainly come back and bring that forward.
Any other questions for Director Olson? Otherwise, I have maybe a few I would ask. Okay, so Director Olson, I guess what you're saying in follow-up to Representative Hillstrom's question, I guess if there was some issue, this is an FY 2019 issue, we'd be back here in early 2019 with some sort of a deficiency request from the department if there were radically different numbers than what you were estimating. Is that what you're saying?
Mr. Chair, that would be our approach. If something that we had not predicted came to light and we need to make some major changes, we would certainly come to this committee to explain those changes.
Okay, and Director Olson, you're saying that even with the reduced revenue, I guess I just want to confirm what Mr. Lee said, even with the reduced revenue, the balance of funding that's in this special revenue account now, plus what you expect to accrue by the time you start to see this in FY 2019, that there's going to be a big enough balance in this account to still have a balance in it even after this reduced revenue?
Mr. Chair, that is our concern, is about the amount of revenue that we do have in existing driver services account. And that's where the revenue would come from to cover the costs of something like this. And so from my understanding or estimation at this time, we do not have sufficient funding in that account.
Wait a minute. So are you saying, now Mr. Lee said there was sufficient funding in the account to deal with the, I guess my question is for FY 2019, which is the biennium that we're dealing with here. Is there sufficient funding in the account or a sufficient balance to get us to the end of FY 2019?
Mr. Chair and members, from my understanding how the special revenue account works, we would solely look at the driver services account. I believe Mr. Lee also talked about the motor vehicle account of revenue as well, and if I'm incorrect, I'll ask him to explain that. But primarily, as we looked when we reviewed this note, we didn't believe there was sufficient funding to cover the full amount of what was needed. But I, you know, I'm prepared to stand corrected if I'm misunderstanding the request.
Okay. Well, I guess I guess Director Olson, I guess my question is, looking at the biennium that we're in, is there enough money to get us to the end of FY 2019, in your estimation? There may be another question as far as 20 and 21.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I stand corrected. Yes, there would be.
Okay. All right. Okay. And I'm wondering, Director Olson, I'm not sure if you were overseeing the people that put together the fiscal note, but I guess I just would ask, you know, in the future, boy, it's a little bit hard to follow where these numbers on the front come from in the back. You kind of have to, at least in my view, do some work to come up with which numbers add up to the numbers in the front. If there was some way when people in the department are doing fiscal notes in the future to sort of just, you know, have a tabulation saying, you know, here's how we got to the $10,113,000. It's these five items above the line or whatever. Just it'd be useful or easier for us to understand it. So I guess I just make that editorial comment. If you could talk to the people that work on it, I'd appreciate it. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if I could get clarification, this money that will now be going for these licenses, where would that money have previously gone? And if it doesn't usually go there, if it's a reserve, what usually would the reserve be in reserve for?
Director Olson.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, DVS has appropriated funds from the special revenue account. So we collect the fees from the transactions that we conduct as part of our organizational mission. We get a portion of those fees that are appropriated to us for our operational. The fees that we're talking about here would be the fees that have not been appropriated. They are just additional fees that we are collecting, and we have them in reserve.
All right, any other questions for Director Olson? Thank you very much for your testimony. Members, I know I had one person that wanted to testify in opposition to the bill, Ms. Twyla Brace, and then one person or group, the Chamber of Commerce, that wanted to testify in favor of the bill. And, you know, underneath the rules, well, we're not looking for extra testimony, but underneath our House rules, we're required to take at least one proponent and one opponent if such people are here. So I haven't heard of anyone else, so I guess, but I see Representative Hausman has a question. Representative Hausman.
Well, Mr. Chair, I had asked about that, and I don't know whether people understood they could, because there would be the one community on the issue of the that lawful status, which we're changing in here. I don't know if anyone representing that particular issue had inquired about testifying. That would be one of the controversial pieces.
I don't believe that. No, we haven't had anyone else contact us about testifying. Yeah. And, of course, that's not really a fiscal issue, but I understood that there was a possibility of an amendment on that being offered.
Having heard the testimony of at least one of the people, I think that their testimony doesn't relate to the fiscal part of the bill.
Yeah. Okay. Well, is Ms. Brace here? Okay. Is there? Oh, I'm sorry. Are you representing Twyla's group?
Yes, I am.
Oh, all right. Okay. All right. Well, sir, if you could state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Matt Flanders, and I'm the legislative specialist with Citizens Council for Health Freedom. Right now, the page is, I believe, passing out a few pages that I would like to bring your attention to. The first is the DHS rule that states that you can still fly without a real ID license. We oppose real ID because we believe that it's an unconstitutional commandeering of the state. And I know that this is a fiscal committee, and so I will keep my remarks to the finances. And if you look at the second page in that packet, it talks about the driver's license security grant program, of which Minnesota received a grant in 2011 after the 2009 prohibition on planning or implementing Real ID. And so we are curious where those funds are, why they were able to apply for them under a prohibition. And so I'll stand for questions as to not get into the other politics of this. But we do oppose this bill, and we hope that this committee will address the concerns that I've stated as well.
Representative Smith, do you have any comments you want to make to Mr. Flanders' testimony?
Mr. Chair, no comment.
Okay. Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I asked in transportation, I asked the department about this issue, and they were going to get the information to us soon, and I'm wondering if they have it ready for us today.
Okay. Is the Department of Vehicle Services here? Someone that could answer Representative Drazkowski's question on this issue. Director Olson, welcome back.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, in regards to the grant that was received, we do have a chronological timeline with all the documentation to support that timeline to explain how, when that grant was applied for, when it was received, and what it was used for. That should be en route to you very soon. The actual implementation date or application date for that grant was 2008. When we received the grant, funds were used for updating our Social Security system, where we do the verification system on Social Security numbers, as well as we got approval from Homeland Security to use that money for enhanced driver's license, for the implementation of enhanced driver's license. All of that documentation in this correspondence that's coming your way shows that, validates that information that was coming, how we got it, what it was used for, and the approval that we got along the way.
Mr. Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Director Olson, for putting that together and outlining what you know so far. Again, as I mentioned in Transportation Committee, my understanding is that these federal dollars were DHS, Department of Homeland Security, grant dollars that were intended for real ID, and they were actually marked or marketed or communicated as such. So we were actually using federal real ID grant dollars when we had a prohibition in place in law. Is that correct?
Director Olson.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, from my understanding at that time period, back in 2008, that was the original language around the grant when it was made available. However, when Minnesota got the prohibition on going forward with any planning of real ID, we posed to Homeland Security that we have statutory authority for enhanced driver's licenses. We got their approval to go forward and implement, using the funding to implement the enhanced driver's license. There was no work done on real ID implementation. And the documentation, like I said, is coming. You'll see that timeline of how that unfolded.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Director. So I trust that that information will contain the actual correspondence between the Department and the Department of Homeland Security seeking and then granting the authorization for repurposing of those dollars so that Minnesota government wasn't in violation of state law. Is that correct?
Director Olson.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, that's correct.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Olson.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And on the sheet that was just handed out, in one of the highlighted portions, it says DHS notes that individuals without a real ID compliant document will still be able to enter federal facilities and board commercial aircraft. For the last several years, I've been under the impression that it was the opposite. Can someone clarify that for me?
Representative Smith, do you want to speak to that?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Representative, the Department of Homeland Security has told us definitively come January 22nd, 2018, you'll be able to board a commercial aircraft carrier with either an enhanced driver's license, a passport, or a real ID.
So what you're saying, Representative Smith, is that this highlighted language relates to the fact that, yes, you could board a commercial aircraft without a real ID, for example, if you had a passport, let's say.
Exactly, Mr. Chair. Yes, exactly. And also, this is a document that is 8 years old, and I'm not sure the origin of it. So without it being the authors, I can't speak to the specifics of it. But the Department of Homeland Security has been very clear with us about the time frame that has been previously discussed about this bill.
Representative Erdahl, follow-up?
Is that includes the federal facilities as well?
Representative Smith.
Oh, I'm Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm sorry. Could you please repeat the question?
Sorry, I interrupted the musical interlude. But Representative Smith, does this include the federal facilities as well?
Representative Smith.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, it does include the federal facilities as well, power plants, military bases also.
Okay. Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, actually the last comment there, I might comment a little bit about. It's my understanding that military bases in particular can establish their own rules. As we all know, military law sometimes comes under different jurisdiction. That doesn't mean that they won't make the same requirement, but the military may or may not accept these IDs or may choose to have other forms of ID, perhaps. But at any rate, where I was headed with this, and to kind of reinforce what Representative Smith was saying, I was in L.A. a while back. My wife was on a separate flight. And at the airports, they're posting signs that the Real ID is going to be implemented. So I'm not sure what this document meant either, but clearly the airline industry is making the public aware with signage and so on at the airports. Now, I didn't happen to notice whether there's signage at ours or not, but I did notice in L.A.
Thank you, Representative Carlson. Representative Babian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to be clear, Representative Smith, our son graduated from the Air Force Academy and is stationed now at a military base. Are you telling me that starting January of 2018, my wife will not be able to get onto that military base, or other parents who have sons or daughters at our military academies are not going to be able to get on those facilities to go to graduations and parents' weekends and so forth?
Representative Smith.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes. In fact, furthermore, it's even happening now. My office has a list of people, citizens of our state, that are traveling to see their loved ones that are either graduating from a program or being sent off to fight for our country, and they're not able to gain entrance into these facilities. Real ID is the federal government is moving towards that requirement for admittance to these buildings. There was there's been a variety of there is some differences among different facility military bases, but that is the direction that they're headed.
Oh, thank you. All right. Was there a representative of the chamber here that also had wanted to testify? And why don't we take your testimony, sir?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Bentley Graves. I'm the Director of Transportation and Healthcare Policy at the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. Just very briefly want to thank Representative Smith for bringing this legislation forward. This has been a priority for ours for the last two sessions. We were very disappointed that that it didn't get resolved at the end of last session. You know, a number of our members require their employees to access efficient air travel to carry out their responsibilities as part of their work, and that's made more difficult by Minnesota's noncompliance, Minnesota being one of only three states. Similarly, as you just heard, while the airplane issue, the air travel issue, will become a very significant issue come January 2018, the issue of accessing federal facilities of any number of kinds is already something that is making business difficult for a number of our members. So we appreciate the quick action to pass this legislation and bring Minnesota in conformity with Real ID. And on this being a fiscal committee, I did want to just mention we also appreciate the extent to which this legislation will kind of take away the barrier to accessing these licenses by ensuring that folks can get them without cost and ensure that, you know, as many folks as possible get them quickly so that, again, commerce can move along in the state of Minnesota. Thank you very much for your support.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just for clarification about your testimony, I understand that the chamber is very supportive of coming into compliance with the Real ID provisions. Does the chamber have a position on the second track that is in this bill and whether or not the language related to status is an issue in the noncompliant license?
Mr. Graves.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we don't have a specific position on the non-compliant track generally. You know, I think we were asked that a lot last session as these ideas were kind of coming together, and I think our position then was, you know, whatever's necessary to give Minnesotans the confidence that they could, you know, make the choice that fit them best certainly would work. When it comes to the status issue, the Chamber has been actively engaged in a coalition of businesses that have advocated the legislature for a number of years for undocumented immigrants to have an option to drive legally in the state. That prohibition, there's currently a prohibition on that sits in regulation. This bill would carry that into law. Frankly, our view on that issue doesn't change one way or the other. We believe that whether that prohibition sits in regulation or in statute, that it is an issue that should be affirmatively addressed by the legislature so that those who are seeking these licenses can have the confidence that it won't be taken away by a whim of administration, and so the business community has some confidence as well.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Graves. And Ms. Brace, we took testimony from one of the other people in your group, but if you had some response to some of the other things that were brought up, I'm gathering you maybe wanted to say something. So welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. Twyla Bray, Citizens Council for Health Freedom. I just wanted to address a few of the things that the author has mentioned just so that you are well aware. So the first thing is the document that's in your hand is the 2008 rule, the Real ID rule that came out of the Department of Homeland Security. You can look that up yourself. That's actually the rule. Nothing has changed about that. And when it comes to flying, even the TSA and Homeland Security says, yes, you can fly without it. TSA has a list of 13 other documents that you can fly with. We just found a military base in Arizona that has 26 identification options, and Representative Carlson. Right, is accurate that the commanders of the bases actually get to make choices, so they could decide a real ID wasn't enough as well in order to get onto a base. And then every time that we have been at one of these committees about real ID, we always hear that we're only one of three states that are not compliant. But here from DHS website itself, everything that's red and everything that's yellow are states that are not compliant. They have not complied with real ID. The ones that are yellow have extensions until June or October. The ones that are red do not have extensions. That means that half the states in the United States are not compliant with Real ID. And then Matt may have said, but there is legislation from at the federal level in order to repeal. Our big thing, other than, of course, the constitutionality, is the fact that the Real ID for federal purposes, that the Secretary of Homeland Security has unilateral authority to decide what those federal official purposes are. Right now they're saying flying, and they're saying federal buildings and nuclear facilities, but they agree on the back side of that page, if Matt also had the back side, I just can't remember, that they do not have to go to Congress and decide. So they could decide that driving is something that becomes an official purpose that you need a real ID for. They could decide that buying ammunition or guns. Anything that they decide, and so this whole idea even of an opt-out, eventually what they can also decide is that there isn't a not-for-federal-purposes card, or it just becomes a moot point because they have decided that so many things are for federal purposes. So it's just very just good for you to know that the federal government doesn't actually have the authority to impose this on the state. It is you, the legislature, who would agree to let the federal government oppose it if you pass this. And that's the reason why there have been five deadlines that have come and gone, and we're on the sixth. In 2012, they said that was their final deadline. In 2013, final deadline. That's what they're saying today, too. But they know they can't impose it because it would be taking over the state authority under the federal government. So they're threatening, and that's a lot of bluff and bluster, and we hope that you will not agree to let our state be our identification, movement, and our access to services be determined by the federal government. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Brace. Are there any other questions to the author of the bill? Otherwise, I'd call upon the author to make any other final comments he'd like to make. Representative Houseman?
have we already acted on the amendments?
We acted on the A-10 amendment. The A-11 amendment is one that actually I had drafted, but upon further review, I'm not sure that it works, and so I wasn't planning on offering it. And the A-12 amendment, I was informed by Representative Carlson, was going to originally be offered, but Representative Hornstein's not here, and at least Representative Hornstein is unable to offer it.
And so, Mr. Chair, this is just final comments to the bill then?
If there are no other amendments that are going to be offered, we'd be on final comments to the bill. Representative Houseman.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to just call attention to that, even though that amendment won't be offered. And the frustration I have on that issue, one, that we don't have a clean bill. We've heard all the urgency, but we've attached this one issue and sort of doubled down on a particular issue. I was so glad that the representative from the business community talked about this, because really there are workforce areas all over the state of Minnesota where there's a necessary workforce there. There is, I'm told by many of the people who are both working there and assisting with some of the support services, there is usually no housing there, and so they have to drive. So that workforce to get to, in most cases, I think it's agricultural purposes, they must drive. Years ago in the Transportation Committee, this was an issue before us, and at the time, it was not controversial. Bipartisanly, everyone understood that it's an advantage for everyone in this state, from the public safety perspective, to have every person driving on the road to be licensed, because if they're licensed, we know they've been trained and they've been insured. That's a good thing. It's a good thing, I think, when we have workforce issues around the state to safely allow workers to get there when there is no housing available. So it's frustrating that it's attached to this bill. It's unnecessary to be attached to this bill and becomes one of those distractions that that puts us further behind a solution that I heard the business community asking for.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, I also wanted to just comment on this, because the Real ID, notwithstanding Ms. Braza's comments, this is something that's starting to impact Minnesotans. I also have been contacted by constituents who can no longer get on a base where their son or daughter is serving, and that's a problem. I think we need to go ahead and deal with this. But I am very disappointed and frustrated that once again the Republican majority just can't do the right thing. And what I mean is, we've got this important bill that needs to move ahead, that we've got some broad agreement. I think the two-track bill that Representative Smith has brought is really a good solution and deals with some of those concerns from Minnesotans who might not want to do the compliant ID. That's a great way to go. But to muddy the waters with this other language about a completely unrelated issue about driver's licenses for people who aren't documented, that is a public safety issue. I think Minnesotans around the state are really starting to understand that, quite apart from the justice issue of it, that this really impacts the state. We want people who we know are driving, who have to drive in their daily lives, we want them to be tested and make sure they drive appropriately and understand the rules just like other drivers. And very importantly, we want them to have insurance. These are separate issues. It is so disappointing that these things are being melded together. We've seen this over and over with this Republican majority. Can't just seem to do the right thing. Keep the issues separated. Move a bill that Minnesotans need right now, right away, the Real ID bill. And don't muddy it up with other stuff that is controversial, apparently. I don't think it should be controversial, as Representative Houseman discussed. But nevertheless, there's no need to, throw rocks at a group of people that don't deserve that, and that even the business community thinks that we should do something else. And here you are muddying the waters with this very important bill. So that's my comment, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Other discussion to the bill? Representative Pulaski.
Mr. Chair, I had the privilege of serving with Representative Smith at the end of last session on the Conference Committee on Real ID. And it was a very instructional service. When the Senate gave its proposal to the House, it took the side-by-sides and it circled parts, it underlined parts, there were arrows, there were balloons, and it was an incomprehensible proposal to members of the legislature. I have no idea what the public thought of it. Representative Smith's proposal was printed, line by line, page by page, with a clarity of each section of the bill so that the public and the members could understand the proposal. Whether you like the bill or not, Mr. Chair, I have to compliment Representative Smith for a presentation that was professional and that could be understood by the public. And I would hope in this legislative session we'll see that in all of our conference committees. It was well done. We didn't prevail because of time, but certainly everybody understood the House position. I have no idea what that thing was that came from the Senate.
It's often a problem, Representative Fluff. Representative Smith, any final comments?
Mr. Chair, members, I ask for your support.
Seeing no further discussion, the Chair will renew his motion that House File 3, as amended, be referred to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. House File 3 is referred to the General Register. Thank you, Representative Smith. Next, we're on House File 235, if Representative O'Neill is here. Representative O'Neill is here. We're passing out some information, but we will recognize Representative O'Neill in a minute once this information has been passed out.
Okay.
Representative O'Neill, looks like there's more information to hand out than I had anticipated. So while we're handing it out, maybe we can get started here. Representative O'Neill, welcome to the Committee on Ways and Means. The Chair will move that House File 235 be referred to the General Register. And Representative O'Neill, do you want to explain House File 235 or do you want to take up the A4 amendment right away?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to take up the A4 to put the bill in the shape that I would like.
Okay. The Chair will move the A4 amendment. Representative O'Neill, can you describe what the A4 amendment does?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The A4 amendment establishes that $100,000 will be in fiscal year 18 for the Department of Commerce to continue the program, the contracts that continue. And I'm going to explain the entire thing in just a minute, but that's in the first part, that's what it does. In the second part, it changes unspent and obligated money remaining in the Renewable Development Fund to just unspent, make it a little bit cleaner and easier to move the money. And then it makes, in Section B, it says in a special revenue fund, it's added a little bit of language to make it a little bit more clear that we are establishing a special revenue fund and not a general fund.
Okay, so this is, amendment is, I don't know if I'd quite say it's a technical amendment, but it's, because we actually are appropriating additional money. But Representative Garofalo, would you like to speak to it?
Yeah, please. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. What the amendment does is it conforms to the fiscal note that we were given. So on page 5 of the fiscal note, you'll see that the administrative costs are estimated at $100,000 a year. So we want to, as the program sunsets and goes away, we want to make sure that we're not dumping an unfunded cost on the department. So we're conforming the bill to the fiscal note. Second of all, on the very top with regards to the energy fund, what we're doing is making sure that those who are currently in the program, they've had a 10-year agreement. We want to make sure that those funds, that make it very clear we're not pulling the rug off from underneath anyone, that if they've signed up and they were they won one of the lotteries the previous 3 years, that they're still going to get those payments over the next 10 years.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Garofalo. Any discussion or other questions to the A4 amendment? Seeing none. All in favor of the A4 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The A4 amendment is adopted. Representative O'Neill, can you explain House File 235 as amended and present your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Yes. As Minnesotans, we lead the nation in innovation and technology. As a state, we've decided to move in the direction of innovative energy that's cleaner and it's cheaper. While we do this process and we move forward, it's important to look critically at the ideas, at plans, and at programs, and course correct when needed. My bill is simply that. It's a course correction. Number one, it repeals the Made in Minnesota Solar Incentive Program. And let me just briefly explain what the Made in Minnesota Solar Incentive Program is. It was passed in 2013. It obligates $15 million each year for 10 years to go into the fund. It goes into commerce. 3 years have already been transferred to the Department of Commerce to pay for 2014, 15, and 16 obligations. Those contracts that have been made will go forward for 10 years. So anything that was contracted in the previous 3 years, as Representative Garofalo just said, will continue to be paid until they're expired after 10 years. Each year from January 1st until February 28th, the Department of Commerce opens up applications for the program. Once that application period is closed, they conduct a lottery. The lottery winners are then informed and told that they can install solar if they choose to. Not all of them choose to. Once the contract has been made, that contract is valid for 10 years, and they will basically receive the incentive on all of the production for those 10 years from the solar panels. The reason that we need to enact this quickly is because if we don't do this now, by the close of February 28th, we'll be obligating another year's worth of commitments into 10 years into the future. If we do this now, we'll be saving $105 million from the Renewable Development Fund. The second part of the bill also moves the Renewable Development Fund uncommitted funds to a special revenue energy fund. Right now, those funds are held in Xcel Energy's private bank accounts, which is highly unusual. There was only one other instance that I could find in my research that something like this was done, and it wasn't done on this scale. According to the legislative auditor, and you have an abbreviated version of the legislative auditor report from 2010, and a full report is also available if you would like that. I have about 20 copies if you want to see the full report, but the pertinent pages are in front of you. The legislative auditor has recommended that we move the Renewable Development Fund from the accounts of Xcel Energy into the state accounts for better transparency, and better accountability. So, members, that is the essence of the bill. And I also have another document to explain a little bit of the change that we made of the $100,000 going into the future for the Department of Commerce to administrate the program. And that is actually, I can pass this out, this actually is also found on the spreadsheet that they gave me of what they would need to administrate the program as it sunsets. And that is all I have, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Representative Wagenius.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative O'Neill, you characterize these changes as course corrections. I would characterize them entirely differently, but let's start with the Renewable Development Fund with an emphasis on the word renewable. When you remove the renewable requirement, you are breaking a 20-year-old agreement where renewable was one of the key provisions when the state allowed Xcel to put casks on Prairie Island. It was an agreement between the tribes, the state, and Xcel. And the biggest part of that that allowed the state to go forward and allow Xcel to do that was that it was going to be a renewable development fund. What you are doing by taking away the word renewable, you're just in effect making this a fund without a moral obligation. It can be called an energy fund. It could be spent for roads. It could be spent for bridges. It could be spent for anything because there's no longer that moral obligation. So that's one thing. The second thing, members, I think we need to talk about the jobs that will be lost if we were to do the abrupt ending of the Made in Minnesota program. The Department of Commerce estimated that 495 jobs were created in the program. It estimates that that will increase to over 1,000 in not too many years. When we had testimony in committee, in the jobs committee, the testimony was that the price of solar was dropping rapidly so that more people were able to participate in this program. That was one thing. The other key testimony was from the folks that actually do the solar installations. And what they were saying is, we know solar is dropping in price so much that we can see a phase out, we can see a sunset. Go ahead and do that. But don't do this abrupt ending because that's when we'll lose jobs in Minnesota. So in the beginning, when the Made in Minnesota was created, there were two companies that made solar panels in Minnesota. Now we have five, and now we have 495 jobs. And for that reason, I'm opposing this bill.
There are, I guess, we heard that there might be some people interested in testifying. Again, we're mostly interested in the fiscal aspects of it, but is there anyone here who is either a proponent or an opponent of the bill that had wanted to testify? I see, and there are a couple of letters from opponents that were passed out that are in your packets. So I see two people that raised their hands. Are you opponents or proponents?
I'm going to support O'Neill.
Okay, and you, sir, in the back in the blue?
I'm not going to support O'Neill.
Okay. All right. Well, there we go. We got one of each. That's perfect. Well, sir, why don't we have the proponent come up first, sir, and then we'll recognize the opponent. Sir, if you could come forward and state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
And this will be the briefest testimony ever heard. My name is Mark Hughes, and I've served 12 years on the Minnesota State Council on Disabilities formally, so I know a little bit about the political game. Been around here a long time, but I'm also a business person. And I haven't looked in the OLA report, but I would hope that Jim Nobles and company have asked the question, why is there money in the private Xcel Energy accounts? That's what I'd like to know. As a businessman, a taxpaying citizen, and I want to support Representative O'Neill right now.
Thank you, Mr. Hughes. Seeing no questions for Mr. Hughes, sir, could the opponent that wanted to testify please come forward? Welcome to the Committee on Ways and Means, sir. Could you please state your name for the record and give us your testimony?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. My name is Michael Allen. I'm with All Energy Solar. We are a local solar energy company based here in St. Paul. We have been for the last, I guess, 2017 now, so almost 8 years. my brother and I started our company in 2009. Worked throughout the country prior to that, and we're really excited in 2009 to actually say, hey, we can bring our company back to Minnesota. We can do solar here in Minnesota, and it was a pretty exciting thing having grown up in South Minneapolis. and we did, and over the last few years, we've been a big proponent of the Made Minnesota Solar program. It's helped build our company. We now currently have 85 employees. We're a building and electrical contractor. Majority of our employees are blue-collar workers. They're electricians, they're laborers, and they're very happy to be employed in this industry. This bill would dramatically reduce our headcount as employees go. That's one component of it, and jobs is extremely important. But I think we also have to look at just what this does to our industry and to our energy makeup as a state. It's unfortunate that we're even having this conversation. Our company works in four different states, and the rest of those states are not having this conversation. It's the exact opposite conversation as to how we can continue to promote more of this. But maybe to put some of this in context, currently there are three types of solar. You have residential rooftop solar. You have large commercial-scale solar, which is some of your community solar gardens. And then you have large utility-scale solar, which is just recently done, the Aurora project, very exciting project that was brought to Minnesota, and great to be here. But I think we have to also then, okay, so we have three different types of programs. Of these three, we're focusing, this bill is specifically focusing on rooftop solar. So what are the programs for rooftop solar in the state of Minnesota? There's two. It's two main programs. First one is Made in Minnesota, and the second one is Solar Rewards. Both of these programs are funded through RDF funds. So not only are we adjusting the allocation of RDF funds for Made in Minnesota, but who's to say that Solar Rewards is not going to experience the same thing? And at that point, we've now eliminated rooftop solar in the state of Minnesota for the most part. I really, it's extremely saddening for me to sit up here and see that we're going in that direction. When such a, in all reality, the dollars and cents that are put towards this are very menial in comparison to what other dollars that are going to be moved around for some of these other projects that provide far less jobs. Our company alone provides 85 people jobs. And we're talking about natural gas power plants that are going to potentially provide 150. Those jobs are all important. All of these jobs are important. Why would we lose some to then add a couple? And in all, and at the end of the day, I believe the bill is called the Job Growth Act. Job Growth and Energy Affordability Act. I don't see any job growth in this. I don't have anything else to say. I appreciate your time, and I'm more than happy to take any questions. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Well, thank you, Mr. Allen. Are there questions for Mr. Allen, Representative Dean?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Allen, for coming today and for employing people in Minnesota. Could you tell me what other states you currently operate in?
Wisconsin, Iowa, and Massachusetts.
So, Mr. Allen, you're in four states, and there's subsidies in all four states. Is that correct?
There are some form of incentive programs, yes, that are incentivizing people in those states.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Allen. And, you know, we subsidize things for different reasons. Sometimes we subsidize industries and jobs just to get jobs online, and sometimes we do that for other policy reasons, like some people might decide that solar is better than natural gas or coal or wind or whatever. And that was obviously the intent of this, I assume, was both. You know, when I remember when this came through, I'm sure I did not support it at that time. But just to kind of look at it from a policy perspective and from somebody trying to operate within these subsidies, just talk a little bit about, you know, Wisconsin in particular, and what are the differences between what they're doing for helping your business and what is Minnesota doing between the two? Because they're neither one is particularly sunny from my uninformed opinion on the subject. So, similar state, similar size. What's the difference?
Certainly,
Mr. Allen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, first, all the states we work in aren't very sunny. But you'd be very surprised that Minnesota is a very sunny place, and you produce a lot of energy from solar panels here in Minnesota. Wisconsin is probably our least revenue generating state within our company. We were originally a Wisconsin corporation, and then moved our company into Minnesota at the end of 2009, early 2010. Wisconsin's programs were essentially killed during that time frame, and majority of jobs in the state of Wisconsin that were in the solar industry were gone. And the solar industry is still struggling to build local businesses, local contractors to do projects in Wisconsin. So a comparison of Wisconsin might not be what we're ultimately looking for, but I think we can look to Iowa. And Iowa has continued to build a pretty strong rooftop solar market. And we're talking small scale, 40 kilowatts. We're only talking 2,000 square feet of space that we're covering up with solar panels on hog barns, farmers, or some homes in many instances. And the state of Iowa currently has a state tax credit, and that's statewide. This program is focused within the investor-owned utility, so we're already very limited with the amount of people that this program reaches. But then on top of that, we don't have anything else for anybody outside of these markets.
And Mr. Allen, excuse me, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Allen, do you have any employees currently in Wisconsin?
Yep.
How many employees do you have?
Three.
Three employees in Wisconsin. All right. Thank you, Mr. Allen, I appreciate being able to ask a couple. I wasn't sitting on the other committees, and I apologize for asking questions beyond direct impact, but I think it is an important thing to look at. We don't often hear from businesses about, you know, where the decisions are made about whether or not to move forward with or without subsidies. So thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate the questions.
Are there other questions for Mr. Allen?
Mr. Chair, may I
respond? Representative O'Neill, sure.
Thank you. I just want to respond ever so briefly because I realize this is the Ways and Means Committee where you talk about the numbers and not the program itself, but I feel like I need to set the record straight if I may. So he had said that a lot of solar is being produced. Let me just put this in perspective since we're talking about since it was raised. The amount of solar since the inception of the program, in this particular program, the amount of solar produced is the equivalent of two of my baseload plants, one in my district, one just outside, operating for a matter of 4 hours. So the entire production of solar for the 3 years that they've been in operation is the equivalent of 3 hours of time that my two plants, baseload plants, produce in about 4 hours of time. Let me put it in another perspective for you. The Aurora Solar Project, which you had mentioned, is 100 megawatts of capacity. Now, I don't want to get into a big discussion about energy because this is not the Energy Committee. But just to put numbers to numbers, apples to apples, the utility-scale solar project that was the first project in Minnesota is 22 sites, and it's 100 megawatts of solar. The entire capacity that we've installed in the 3 years that this program has been in existence is 7.7 megawatts. So 7.7 megawatts and 100 megawatts. Let me put it in a further perspective for you. The new resource plan that Xcel Energy just rolled out with utility scale solar is 2,400 megawatts of solar. This has produced 7.7 megawatts of solar since its inception. Seven. Let's put this in perspective, please. Let's talk about the cost, since this is a fiscal committee, not the energy committee. The cost to install 7.7 megawatts and produce a whopping total of 10,157 megawatts, which I told you could be produced by two baseload plants in a matter of 4 hours, not 3 years. The cost in the first year was 31 times market rate for the business owners in here, 31 times the market rate. That includes the administrative cost to Department of Commerce. The second year, they brought it down to 5.75 times the market rate. And the last year that we just got numbers for was 13 times the market rate of utility scale solar. So let me just put that in perspective in comparison to what he just said. Let me also say one thing about the jobs. So this money comes out of the Renewable Development Fund. It was obligated to the point of $150 million obligated out of, it is the ratepayers' money. Xcel Energy ratepayers pay that into the Renewable Development Fund. So this is an obligation of $150 million. And out of 3 years, so that's 15 plus 15 plus 15, so $45 million has been committed over the past 3 years, and we have produced enough electricity that's the equivalent of 4 hours of two of our baseload plants. Again, 7.7 megawatts of capacity.
Mr. Chairman, may I?
Mr. Allen.
Thank you. I do want to talk numbers. I think that's important, and we're at the Ways and Means Committee, and I'll just make it very brief. And we do need to put it into perspective. We all do, because we all have lots of people that we represent. I don't necessarily, not a voted member in, but I have a lot of people that I support and represent in our company. I'm reading Xcel Energy, their annual report to the Minnesota State Legislature, February 13, 2015. We want to talk about costs. The cost of the RDF program expenses allocated to Minnesota are recovered through an adjustable surcharge on our customer bill statements as part of their monthly charges for electricity. In 2015, the RDF charge is 0.000563 cents per kilowatt hour. For a typical residential customer, using 750 kilowatt hours per month, the RDF cost per month is 42 cents. Let's put it in perspective, please.
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It was my understanding from the Department of Commerce that actually 15 megawatts have been created in this industry that is expanding like this. And if Bill Grant could come up, I think we could have a better idea of what the accurate numbers are for the creation.
Okay, we'll take some brief testimony. We do have another bill here, too, though. So, Mr. Grant. Mr. Grant, welcome to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Bill Grant for the Department of Commerce. Just to clarify the numbers that we've given Representative O'Neill and others, the 7.7 megawatts that she referred to are the number of megawatts currently under contract. It does not include the number of megawatts added in the last program year, which doubles the amount of capacity that we expect from 7.7 to 15 megawatts, 15.
Okay. Representative Wagenius, did you have some other questions for Mr. Grant?
I didn't. That was the one.
Okay. All right. Representative, I don't see any other questions. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Hausman.
If we're approaching final passage, I just wanted to say just a few things. The frustration, I happened to serve on that conference committee back in 1994, and that was a hard-fought battle and a negotiated agreement. That actually has done what it was intended. I mean, as we look at solar and wind and biomass, we were making some progress, and it's outlined. If you haven't had a chance to read the letters from the two companies, to do exactly what we'd hoped, and that is there are companies we've attracted. They point out that while Minnesota does not have any of our own fossil fuel resources, it does have plenty of wind and sunshine, and that's where we put our resources to develop. And they reference the amount of private investment in solar projects that have begun as a result. And not to know what we're going to do instead. We just say we're not going to do this anymore. And it's an open question. Are we going to build roads and bridges with it, Representative Torkelson? I think you're free to do that now because we just free it up from this use and we spend it in some other way. But the thing that concerns me most, and I know we only have these two bills, but there's a third bill, three bills passed out of committee. And what concerns me is the movement we're making away from the function of the Public Utilities Commission. And my understanding, at its heart, that is the function that's supposed to protect the consumer against high energy costs. They have to do the deliberate work, the careful consideration to determine how is the consumer going to be protected in this particular area of government. Instead, in one fell swoop, in three bills, one that's gone directly to the floor and these two, we are now, the legislature is moving in to take some fairly dramatic, rapid action that changes that whole scenario. And, of course, when we move so dramatically from a direction that has some history to it, and that has careful consideration behind it, to an unknown, we don't know how that money is going to be spent, when the legislature moves in that direction, I worry about unintended consequences. There's so much that we don't know yet as we move these bills forward. So I regret our moving away from that history of 1994. I regret that we were turning away from what I think was real promise in the use of that fund, and that we've taken some teeth out of the very entity that I think was put in place to protect this consumer.
Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, just to piggyback on some of the comments by Representative Hausman, Interesting enough, being that it was quite a few years ago, there are two members of this committee that were on the conference committee at the time. Representative Houseman and myself, earlier this morning, I thought Representative Wagenius had been, but I think what I maybe was remembering, we had a lot of conversations at the time about this. But it was a very contentious issue before the state of Minnesota, millions of dollars being spent on both sides relative to nuclear storage at Prairie Island. And it was NSP in those days, and in conference committee we had basically two schools of thought. In fact, my role, I'll just share that with you, I was already on two conference committees at the time dealing with education because I chaired the education committee, and I got a note from the speaker, and he wanted to talk to me about conference committee, and I thought he wanted an update. And he said, Lynn, I'm thinking of putting you on the NSP Prairie Island conference committee. And I said, I'll be informal. This was an informal discussion. I said, I haven't been involved with the issue. And he said, well, I'm going to appoint two people from the environmental side within the legislature and two proponents of NSP. And he said, I have two requests if I appoint you to that conference committee. He said, one, I'd like you to see if you can help work out a compromise. And two, which I'll kind of smile at it a little bit, but there was some geology involved. He said the other request is that you not do any nuclear storage in Kuching County. For those of you that know where he was from, it was International Falls. The reason he made that statement, but the geology, there's a lot of granite. I suppose if he would have represented Stearns County, Mr. Chairman, he might have said not in Stearns County. But that was in reference to that. Apparently, maybe at some point they had been talked about. So the compromise that the committee worked out was essentially that there would be 450 megawatts of wind energy to be developed mainly at Buffalo Ridge in southwestern Minnesota, 50 megawatts of biomass. Now, where did that those 500 megawatt numbers come from? That was the equivalent of one reactor at Prairie Island. There are two reactors down there. I think Monticello, if I recall correctly, has one reactor. So that's where that number happened to come from. Did NSP at the time or now Xcel come willingly to the table on that? No. But like a lot of compromises, you know, you have to have some give and take. Were the environmental, was the environmental community happy with the fact that we were going to grant then as part of that compromise, it was either 14 or 16 casks that would be stored at the plant. And then an idea that came out of the conference committee was that in exchange for the storage, there would be $500,000 per cask to create the renewable energy fund or the alternative energy fund, as I sometimes called it. So that's the history of it, and I see that being unwound here. There's really no definition, as I see in the bill, of what the energy fund is going to be. But the other important thing I want to point out is that that $500,000 per cask to be stored there, first of all, I should footnote that was to be temporary. That was to be ultimately moved to Yucca Mountain in Nevada, and you know, nobody wants the nuclear energy stored, so in the U.S. Senate, the majority leader ended up being from that state, and that was the end of the development of Yucca Mountain. Some people, by the way, just called it Yucca Mountain because of the nuclear part of that. But I know I'm taking quite a bit of time here and maybe even being part of the testimony in a sense. But I think it's important that people know that history. But the one other final comment I'm going to make is that that $500,000 is a fee assessed to the people in the Xcel now service area. And the idea was then that they were being assessed that fee to develop alternative energy sources. So, Mr. Chairman, I have a lot of concerns about this particular bill, not only because of my personal history, but one of the things that came out of that, my involvement at the time, and I had probably prior to that had the speaker at the time ask me, I leaned rather heavily toward the development of alternative forms of energy. But the industry was not warm to it initially. They had a lot of excuses, costs, transmission lines. But, one other footnote. About 2 years later, full 2 pages in the Tribune, a big article, I think either paid for or developed by the power company, NSP, talking about all the good attributes of that compromise. And you'd have thought they had developed the compromise, but it really came out of the conference committee, and it was a mandate. But that was never mentioned. But they were then fully aboard 2 years later in terms of the development of alternatives. So just a little bit of history there, Mr. Chairman. I think that this bill, for a variety of reasons, raises a lot of questions, and I hate to see it moving forward at this point in time. But thank you for allowing me to take the time.
Thank you. I'm going to recognize Representative Garofalo, and then I don't have anyone else on the list. I'll go back to the author briefly if she has anything else to say. Representative Garofalo.
Mr. Chairman, members, I just want to thank Representative O'Neill for carrying this bill. First of all, with regards to the Renewable Development Fund, I think it's important to remember that this is an exact opposite of what we proposed in 2012. In 2012, we tried insulating the legislature from using these funds. We tried turning it over to a nonpartisan, nonpolitical technical board, the Renewable Development Fund Board. We did that, and it lasted about 6 months. And 6 months later, about $175 million was drained out of it by the legislature. And so I want to thank Representative O'Neill for having this bill so that if the legislature is going to be appropriating funds from this, that, number one, it be under public, not private control, as the Office of the Legislative Auditor has recommended. In addition, that if the legislature is going to be appropriating funds from this account, that everyone has a chance to compete for it, not just there's not two sets of rules for some people who are applying to the board. Second of all, I want to thank Representative O'Neill for getting rid of the Made in Minnesota solar program. It's an embarrassment for the state of Minnesota. It's embarrassing to the renewable energy industry as well as clean energy advocates. By any metric of success, whether it's reducing pollution, creating jobs, or incentivizing new technology, it doesn't do those things. This bill passed on a bipartisan vote of 14-4 in committee, and I look forward to working with those on the other side of the aisle who wish to learn more about the issue. And thank you again, Representative O'Neill.
Representative O'Neill, the author of the bill, any last comments?
I just ask for your support and just know that the Energy Committee will be taking up what do we do now with the newly created Energy Fund. And so there will be lots more discussion as we move forward, and I ask for your support.
All right. At this time, the chair renews his motion that House File 235, as amended, be referred to the General Register. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. House File 235, as amended, is referred to the General Register. Representative Baker. Representative Baker moves that House File 234 be referred to the General Register. Representative Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I do not have an amendment, so the bill in front of you is what I would actually like to see carried forward. This also was examined well in our Jobs and Energy Committee, had good bipartisan support. What this bill really is a we're calling it a local democracy bill for our county and rural co-ops for electricity in our rural Minnesota. 2 years ago when we passed net metering legislation that was passed by the governor, we offered and made that ability to allow the local co-ops and munis to be able to have an interconnection charge so that their costs are being protected for the infrastructure costs that they have had over the years. So some companies then have elected to do a $2.75 monthly fee, a $5.88 monthly fee. Some are averaging in the mid-20s. But what this does is it protects the folks that have invested in solar to make sure that if they do need electricity when they need it, when the power is not shiny bright, that they are able to tap into the grid. And those fees that are there kind of protect those infrastructures that have been put in place. What this does is it isolates then our local boards to be able to make those decisions locally, so it doesn't have to be brought up to the PUC when there's somebody in question about wanting to question that fee. So I do have people that could testify if we need to, Mr. Chair. I don't know that we need to unless there's technical questions that we have. But again, this basically clarifies policy in the Minnesota Statute 216B, which just clarifies so that these local boards that are elected locally, that are owned locally by members of our neighbors and our churches that own and operate this local operation, can formally make this conversation and make these decisions wholly at home. So with that, I'll just take some questions. If we need any other discussion, I'll look for those, Mr. Chair.
Well, thank you, Representative Baker. No one contacted us about giving testimony. If someone is interested, they should come forward. I have Representative Wagenius with a question. Representative Wagenius.
Well, more of a statement, Mr. Chair. We all love local control. And there are always more than one way to skin a rabbit around here. The problem I see with this way of doing local control is it will have the effect of preventing folks in outstate Minnesota from putting solar on their residences, on their small farms, on their pig farms, or on their small businesses. So the unintended consequence, I think it's unintended, is that those of us who live in the metro will have an opportunity to put solar on our roof that folks in outstate Minnesota won't have. So, members, I live in Minneapolis. I have solar on my roof. The panels provide for almost all of our solar, not quite, but almost. We also have a farm in Douglas County. And it turns out that because our farm in Douglas County is all, the farmhouse is all electric, you know, electric hot water heater, electric stove, we use about the same amount of electricity in our farm in the summer, maybe 3 months, that we do in our house in the city all year. So I checked up on Runestone Electric, which is our provider out there, and I looked online to see what, if any, fees the Runestone would charge now. Runestone doesn't charge a flat fee if you put solar on your roof. It's an increasing fee that goes like this. The bigger your array, the bigger your fee. So that's a problem. It would be risky for me to put solar on the farm. But then this is what Runestone Electric says. It's a notice to members that rates may change over time of the contract due to action of the cooperative. So basically it is not just risky because there are fees, but it's very risky because those fees can change over time. So right now the POC would settle a dispute between a member of the co-op and a co-op itself. And so the reason I think you see this bill before you is because there is one co-op that's charging $83 a month for the solar array. And so that went to the PUC for settlement. And rather than letting the PUC be the arbitrator of this, now it will be the utility itself, which, from my point of view, means, my gosh, if it were me and in Douglas County and in Runestone Co-op, I would lose and they would win. So my worry about this bill, and I think getting to some of the issues you may want, the bill could be written differently, but to make it too risky for solar is probably the unintended consequence, and I think the bill needs
some work.
Can't vote for it at this time. Maybe there's another time when, if it's rewritten and actually doesn't have unintended consequences and protects the person who was being charged $83 a month, I think maybe we could get someplace.
Representative Baker, any response you want to make?
The only comment I would make, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Guineas, for those comments. I did ask, the co-ops have a basic formula that they all follow. Some of the rates, if they're higher, like an $83 example that Representative Guineas gave us, is on the same basis of a formula as the smaller usage of the solar investment. We could have, if you need to, Jim Horan to come down and explain that formula, but also trying to keep it to the policy, or I'm sorry, to the finance part to this committee hearing. The fiscal note was passed out as well. That should have been in your packet, but again, this is saving about $50,000 for the PUC because we do have a couple of dockets on their plate, basically, to kind of handle, and this takes care of that as well. Typically, if a co-op is brought in front of the PUC, it's about a 4 to 6 month minimum window, probably a $30,000 to $50,000 average cost to the utility, which again will eventually be paid by the ratepayers. So we're trying to make sure that this decision can be made locally by boards that we can trust. So that would be my comment, Mr. Chair.
Representative Pawlowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to talk a little bit about the bill, too. House File 234 was originally drafted this past summer at the request of Tri-County Electric in Rushford. I was asked to assist on the draft. It was decided that we would run the bill in the Winona Model Legislature, and we had 131 students that have 2 days at Winona State. We have a bill book of 380 pages. They elect a governor. They have 9 standing committees. I want to talk about the preparation for the bill. Representative Davids assisted me in one of the 2 90-minute preparations for all of the seniors at Rushford Peterson High School. One of them was the daughter of a Tri-County Electric board member. She carried the initial draft. Representative Draskowski attended the first day of the Winona Model Legislature. Secretary Simon started and opened the session identically the way he does this week or this past month with us. I want to talk about the bill being prepared locally. It's a Greater Minnesota bill. The idea came from a Tri-County Electric in Rushford, Minnesota. And I don't think that's the name anymore. They've changed it since the merger. But Representative Davids worked on it. Representative Draskowski was there that day and saw the students preparing for it. It was the last bill signed by the model legislature governor, and it had to go through the House and Senate twice before they finally signed it the way we see most of it today. So this bill has had some preparation. It's had preparation locally. It's had at least 3 members of this committee who are at least part of the early preparation on it. So I want to talk about one other thing. We talk about hands-on learning. This is hands-on learning in an educational environment with 131 students from 7 different educational institutions, private schools, public schools, and colleges. This is what we should do with students. And by the way, it's nonpartisan. So there are no Republicans, there are no Democrats. They just debate policy and personalities, and there's a lot of both. I want to thank Representative Davids for his assistance that day, and also Representative Draskowski for attending it. But it is not too often we get to have a bill that's actually been prepared initially by students.
Representative Carlson.
Yeah, I was just wondering if Representative Pawlowski could yield to a question. Did you have a similar project or a project dealing with the storage of nuclear waste at NSP Prairie Island?
Representative Pawlowski.
Representative Carlson and members, I ran for an entire week in my model legislature a scenario of the entire issue of dry cask storage. We ran it in multiple classes, and we ran it in multiple schools. I used all the primary source material. The one thing you will note about the Winona Model Legislature, it works only with bills that are either drafted for or introduced in the Minnesota legislature. So, yes, Representative Carlson, I did, and I stole a lot of your material, and I used it week after week after week. And your name was dropped several times in the course of that presentation.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, it was in other circles as well at the time, but I when he was talking about the most recent one, I had recalled, and I just wanted to put that on the table. That's not the bill before us, but it was part of our agenda here this morning. But it does reinforce what he's saying, and I'm a retired social studies teacher as well, about the value of hands-on learning. So I would compliment him in that regard.
Okay, seeing no further questions, Representative Baker, any last words on the bill?
Mr. Chair and committee, I would really appreciate your support.
Representative Baker renews his motion that House File 234 be referred to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. House File 234 is referred to the General Register. Members, the meeting next week, I'm anticipating, will be reviewing the governor's budget, which is due to come out tomorrow. There may be other bills we have, but stay tuned. With that, members, seeing no further business, we are adjourned.